Hi, I'm Simon Campbell.
And I'm Susie Starlight from the Starlight Campbell Band.
Welcome to the Supertone Show.
We'll be right back.
Roll over, lay down, status quo.
A bit rude.
1973, a bit rude.
Status Quo, what an amazing band. We had to play some Quo on the show.
I know.
And this early stuff is really fantastic. I saw them, I've seen them twice, and the first time was at the King's Hall, which used to be in Bellevue in Manchester.
Yeah.
And it was like an old boxing ring. And the support band was Montrose, Ronnie Montrose, playing guitar. And it was a great evening. But they opened with this very song. And I'm not kidding. I was jumping up and down with the rest of the audience on the wooden seats that were there. And it was like matchwood at the end of the gig. Everything was broken because, everybody was just jumping because as soon as they started, everybody's jumping up and down. It was like the original Pogo. And they were absolutely awesome. They had really long hair and they had their heads bent right in front of the stage, all three of them, drummer at the back there. And it was a driving gig. In fact, I think it's one of the best energetic gigs I've ever been to. Everybody was sweating. You know, when you came out and everybody smelt of sweat and it wet through. It was amazing.
Now, what is it about Quo? Because when I first came across them, I think they kind of peaked in terms of, from what I understand, when they were the early years, they were really rocky and really like a real credible band. And then they almost became a bit sort of cameo-esque with themselves. Or they didn't take themselves seriously and they were a little bit of a maybe jokey band in a way. Because it's like, I used to hear people saying, no, you don't like Quo, And actually, when you hear their early stuff, there's some serious shit there. They really
are. Driver, Hello. I mean, these are great records. And even there, when you listen to it again on Cans, because I'm loving doing this show because I'm listening to stuff on Cans and I'm hearing all the little mistakes, and you can hear him. And on there, you can hear Francis Rossi changing his pickup selector from two pickups to one pickup on his Telecaster. You can hear it goes click. You can hear the click. And, they're obviously doing it live, and there's little mistakes. It's fantastic. Absolutely tremendous, And the power, because Francis Rossi, talk about a rhythm guitar player. My God. I think he used to use medium gauge strings, which are like 12s, and oh god, incredible sound.
I know exactly what you're saying, but I was just looking into their style as well, and they're described as a brand of boogie rock. And I remember when we had Blueberry Pie, our album reviewed, and there was Empire. There's a track called Empire that we've written, and it was described as a boogie. And I'm thinking, a boogie? This is rock. It's got a bounce, and now. Finally, I connect up because basically boogie rock came out of the hard blues rock of the late 60s and it was largely designed for dance parties with a repetitive driving rhythm in place of instrumental experimentation.
Well, I'm going to have to say it. Well, when you went to the rock clubs in the 70s, I used to play an awful lot, they were there and, the audience, and they were there. I'm not quite sure I can say this, but I'm going to say it anyway. And the audience used to get into this position in big lines and do the wanking monkey. That's what it was called. The wanking monkey dance. And they were there, and they were all in lines. And when we were playing, they used to do the same thing. And it was an amazing sight to see all these hairy-ass bikers all dressed in leather and the women, and it was just amazing, big boobs, all leathered up, It was an incredible sight. And that's when, it was really at its height, because people used to love Quo, really, really did. And again, that features fuzz guitar. More fuzz. Every track we play, it's got fuzz on it. And I believe that's the color tone sound bender that is on that track. That's why. It's true.
I've gone bright red here, and I can hardly speak. I've just got this I'm frozen.
Yeah, well, we don't need to be frozen because now we have something that's going to soothe you and thaw you out very quickly.
There's something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there, telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Battle lines being drawn. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speaking their minds are getting so much resistance from behind. Time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. A field day for the heat. A thousand people in the street singing songs and carrying signs. Mostly say hooray for our side. It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Your life, it will creep. It starts when you're always afraid. Step out of line, the man come and take you away. We better stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. We better stop now. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
Buffalo Springfield, For What It's Worth, written by Stephen Stills.
Released as a single in January 1967. Now, I like Stephen Stills. I didn't really know that that was him, by the way, because I'm not really good with people's names.
Well, Stills, he's everywhere. And there's a lot of stuff, Manassas, that we listen to an awful
I
lot.
I love Manassas.
Yeah. Buffalo Springfield, of course, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. And then that Cooper Stills super session that was done with Mike Bloomfield that I think we're going to play a track from next week. I mean, he's done an awful lot of really cool stuff. And he's like the white man's prince. He's multi-instrumentalist. And he's such a cool guy. He's a great guitar player, great singer, great songwriter. But he's sort of in the undercurrent, isn't he? He's a bit of a swampy character.
What I realised, you know, when we were watching that video with Tom Jones, I see this is the thing, I could not believe that Tom Jones was singing with these guys, and you've got Neil Young there, and the
looks
whole...
like he likes a slapped arse, doesn't he? He's got a face like a slapped arse, old Neil.
It was.
Yeah, looks like his mum's told him off.
He does.
You need to get those sideboards cut, lad.
He does. He's got this really cool kind of beard formation going on that nearly goes to the centre.
You said
of his...
he looked like a monkey. Come on.
He just looked really strange because it was just the most weird thing, and he had this look. But obviously Stephen Stills, what I didn't realise is that he was doing all the echo chorus-y bits to Tom Jones, and he was going for it. He reminded me a bit of the guy from Focus as well, you know, on the keys. Because he's there going, wah, 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 wah. And he's just like, and I just... Sometimes I'm amazed by what I hear men do in songs. It's like when we're listening again on Cancer, this song, right? So you've got the main vocals in the right ear,
yeah.
All the harmonies, the backing vocals on the left. And what always gets me is when men sing, ooh.
Well, you know, in the studio, because I've lived in the studio for 40 years, really, and oohs and ahs are the worst thing in the world, because if you don't get them right, they can sound absolutely terrible, you know. And oohs are difficult. Ahs are easier.
But in real life, you know, like in talking life, not singing life, you know, if you say ooh, it's a bit...
Ooh.
Yeah. But to actually get like a really serious, you know... artist going ooh, it's I mean, where did the oohs come from anyway?
Well, I don't know. And you know, the other thing that gets me, just comparing the first two tracks on this show, right?
Yeah,
you've got Status Quo, and I've said this before about the British bands, it's raw, it's energetic, it's powerful, it's got there's mistakes in it. It's like there, and then you go into the smooth, baby, the American yeah. sound, you know, which is really a lot more sophisticated, and the playing actually is a higher standard. It's more, but it's juxtaposed between the two, you know, and I love that British sound. I really love it because it's got energy. It's a, you know, I don't give a shit sort of sound, you know.
Yeah.
Whereas the American sound, it's, did you play a B flat there, man? You know, like, yeah, that thing there, really good, you know. And it's like, you know, and they'll go back and analyse it. Whereas in Britain, they'll just get back and, you know, have a few more spliffs and a couple more pints of bitter, you know.
There you go. The light pours out of me by Magazine.
You've got a great radio voice, you know.
Thank you, darling.
It's
Where
true.
Did that come from?
Every time. You go, hi, it's, you know, Susie Starlight.
Yeah, it's Behave absolutely- yourself. No, talking about this song, you introduced me to this song.
Well, I did. And Magazine is one of those post-punk bands that I really got. Of course, they're from Manchester. Howard Devoto on vocals. And I was very proud to share a stage with them at Deeply Vale.
Yeah.
Now, that's right, when I played there with Tim Wright and the mates from Whitefire and stuff in the late 70s. And, of course, Dave Formula, the keyboard player who's on this album, played on my last solo album, The Knife, and he played some keyboards on it, some Hammond and piano.
We met Dave. He's a lovely gentleman.
He's a great guy.
Yeah.
Lives in Lincolnshire.
Yeah. I always remember coming to the studio and he had this really healthy sandwich.
Is that
really
right?
Really obscure things that you remember. And I loved his spirit. He seemed really kind.
Yeah.
Gentle. And played like a bitch, if you know what I mean. Just played really beautifully as well.
Well, he's a great keyboard player.
Yeah.
And of course, he was in Visage as well, wasn't he?
This is the strangest thing, you know, when people play in so many different bands. If you're not a front person, it's incredible when you start to look into all these bands, how, like, before Dave formed joined Magazine, he was briefly playing with the Manchester band who had some success called the St. Louis Union. And it's amazing how people chop and change. It seems a little bit, I don't know.
Well, it's a scene, you see. We're going about this scene quite a lot, you know. And when you're in the scene, you sort of just move about and do stuff. And of course, Howard Devoto used to be in the Buzzcocks.
Yes.
And Pete Shelley actually co-wrote this song and the single, Shot by Both Sides. And if you listen by Shot by Both Sides, it's the same riff, actually, as a Buzzcocks song as well. So he's obviously plagiarised his own song, which is nothing wrong with that.
Ah, and that was produced by John Leckie as well, and we know him.
Yeah, sexy boy, Leckie.
Talking about sexy boy, actually, I was working on the very, very first Manchester International Festival in 2009, it was. And I was managing the big tent thing and all the acts and was working with all the bands and stuff. And
a big erection.
Yeah, and we had this movie footage of I think it was the Sex Pistols playing at the Free Trade Hall.
Mm.
I think it was. And there was no sound, though. And one night, this guy in like a flasher mat came, just walked in, you know, like a Macintosh.
Mm.
And he just came in and he stood there and he looked up.
Is that a computer?
No, it's a guy wearing a garment of clothing.
Ba-bum,
like a coat. And he just stood there for a while, watched the footage and then just left. And it was Howard Devoto. And that was him just checking out because he'd supplied the footage for the festival.
Well, the Buzzcocks were formed following that Sex Pistols gig. Very true. Because I remember the Buzzcocks and Pete Shelley and that lot were at Deeper Vale as well. And I remember being in a tent with them. It was like one of these big old teepee things. And I'm not a smoker, but I was smoking. And, so we were there, and it was all cool, you know, because everybody used to in Manchester, they all got together, and it was a very, very, you know, really cool scene in those days. The Beatles and The End.
Feels
not
a bit
the
sad,
Doors,
really.
The End, of course. It's no. It's from The Beatles, The End.
It's funny that they both have a song called The End, isn't it?
Mm.
So this is the last song that was recorded collectively by all four Beatles.
Correct.
Because there were other... The Let It Be was released after. This is the last recording they did together.
That's right, but yeah. Let It Be was recorded before.
Yes.
With all the Phil Spector debacle.
Do you know, it's so complex, the Beatles. So interesting. And
well, if you want to know about the Beatles, the best book to read is the Jeff Emmerich book, right? And he was the engineer who really created the sound of the Beatles, because everybody thinks it was George Martin, but it wasn't. George Martin did the, you know, he advised on the songs, he did all that old school producer thing, because the producer used to deal with the session musicians, and I mean, he obviously orchestrated a lot of stuff, George Martin, a bit of a genius in that respect, but the sounds all came from Jeff Emmerich. And Jeff Emmerich, he was groundbreaking, and I've read the book, and he was talking about this track, and the Leslie, the guitar through the Leslie speaker, which had, for anyone that doesn't know, it's like it's a really old school thing. It's a big box with a couple of speakers in that whirl round on motors.
It looks fantastic. It looks like one of those old kind of fairground things that you'd hear, you know, and like a pipe organ almost. It's
well,
like
that's
a
right.
And it's rotating like drum with some horns.
Well, there's a couple of horns sticking out the top and stuff, and then there's this bass speaker that rotates at the bottom. But it creates that sort of Doppler effect. It goes whoa, 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 and it actually gives a slight pitch shift as well because of that. And it's an amazing piece of kit. We've got one.
Yeah,
we've got
a
145, old valve thing, you know, and you fire it up with trepidation because fire it up is the right word.
Yeah.
You have to power it off the organ, the Leslie organ, and all the power and everything goes down this multi-core cable. And it's known as the killer cable because, you know, it's not really great from an insulation and isolation point of view.
It's old technology in that respect.
Yeah. But anyway, Jeff Emmerich, but he recorded the guitar through Leslie the first time. When John Lennon and the guys were looking for a sound, and this is a few albums before, this was later on. But the interesting thing about this track is that though that guitar solo at the end, Ringo didn't want to do a drum solo. He hated doing drum solos. He hated drum solos. But that drum solo right at the beginning, they really pushed him to do. And it sounds really good, you know. It's not technically brilliant, but it's perfect for the track, as Ringo always was. And then the three solos afterwards were all done by the individual Beatles. It was George Harrison, Paul McCartney and John Lennon, and they all took turns. So those, it's not just one, you know. And it's great. And the reason why I play that, you know, today, is like it's just... it's such a quirky Beatles song because it's much more instrumental. And then you get those lovely, lush harmonies coming in and then the orchestration and then that beautiful Leslie solo at the end.
The love you take is equal to the love you make.
Albert, Albert, where you stay that night? Alberta, Alberta, where you stay that night? Where you come home this morning, clothes ain't fitting you right. Alberta, Alberta, where you been so long? Albert, Alberta, where you been so long? Ain't had no loving since you've been gone. Alberta, Alberta, where you been so long? Alberta, Alberta, where you been so long? Ain't had no loving since you've been gone.
Alberta by Snooks Eaglin. What a name. What a man.
Eaglin?
I know. Great name.
The eagle now, flies at dawn.
That song, can you feel the history in that song? There's loads of different versions of that song, but that was released written originally by Leadbelly in 1935.
Mm.
And it was released as the B-side of a single in 1961. So, and guess what the A-side to that single was?
I have no idea.
That's all right, Mama.
No.
Yep.
Ah, so Snooks then did a cover of That's All Right, which wasn't originally an Elvis Presley song anyway.
No.
Right, okay. Well, that's all right. That's cool. I'm really gripped by that song because what I like about it, I like the... You know, his vocal, it sounds like he's got a mouthful of marbles. That's the first thing. And that lovely 12 string, because he's using a 12 string on that, and it's really gentle sounding 12 string. It's a beautiful thing. And you've got a bit of a story about this song, haven't you?
Yeah, I have actually. The first time I ever. That's weird, you know, because that's why I chose it.
Yeah.
It's the first time I heard this as a friend of mine called John Wood from Mosley. He built my 1966 Ariel Colt 200cc. It's my bike. And he plays guitar and he sat on the porch many years ago now over in Laxey and sang this song. It's like, oh, bird. I went, Woody. That's a great song. Teach me this song. And it was just like brilliant. So I love that's the first time I heard that song was when Woody sang it.
Well, the funny thing is when you listen to that as well, is that you can almost hear Eric Clapton singing it because Eric Clapton did like a version of it later on.
In 1992 and it's Unplugged.
Yeah. And it sounds almost identical because his voice is like kind of similar, you know, and it's quite lovely. But I love what I like about it. It's the groove of it. It's like a real lilting groove, and that's the way it's played is just lovely.
And Snooks has got an interesting backstory as well because just after I was around when he was about 1 year old, he lost his sight due to glaucoma.
No.
Yeah, and he spent several years in hospital with various ailments apparently, and had a guitar. At five, and he taught himself to play by listening to songs on the radio, and then he won a competition and a radio like a talent competition from a radio show, and then he left to be a full-time musician, and he was discovered again like so many of his time playing on the streets of New Orleans.
Is that right?
Yeah. There was a guy called Dr. Harry Oster, a folklorist from Louisiana State University, got him in the studio for a couple of years. And that was more folk blues, this one. And then later on, though, he's more renowned for his New Orleans R&B style. But they used to call him the human jukebox because he could play anything. Wow. And the last point I want to make as well, he reminds me of you. Because at live shows, he usually didn't prepare set lists. It was unpredictable, even to his bandmates, quote unquote. And I'm thinking about how sometimes when I play in the band with you, I don't know what you're going to do.
Well, the thing is, neither do I. Lady Grinning Soul by David Bowie from the Aladdin Sane album.
Mm. You almost can see James Bond standing in the back there, can't you? Or
yeah,
it's a bit, it's a little bit James Bond film feel, that song.
It is. That, and I remember listening to this when I was at school, and the album came out when I was there, and that piano, Mike Garson's piano, just completely captivated me. And what I loved about it was that delay from the beginning. It starts off and there's that big sort of really, you know, big piano thing, and then it just stops and all decays out. And then Bowie comes in with the most dramatic, you know, it's fantastic amount of timing. It's great. And you know, the other thing I love about this song is Mick Ronson's guitar, because this is really one of the last times he worked with Ronson and the Spiders from Mars. And it was an amazing period of time, of course. But Mick Ronson's guitar, again, is so beautiful, so appropriate. He was such a great musician. Everybody thinks about him, you know, with his huge platform heels on and his silver spangly pants. But he was a great musician all round. And his acoustic guitar playing, electric guitar playing. And on this, David Sanborn on sax as well, one of the great sax players of all time, you know?
Yeah. It's do you know as well, that's the highest note that David Bowie ever sung in the recorded
You keep coming up with these stats and you hide them from me. I had
do.
No idea.
I know, I'm doing little cryptic clues to remind me so you can't read the notes. Got ya. Yeah, but is that because I was listening out for it, it's like, whoa. Yeah, it's very, very dramatic. It's a little Shirley Bassey as well.
Yeah,
in that
sense.
With
Shirley.
No, we love Shirley. And that was the B-side of Rebel Rebel, you know, when it was released as a single in the USA.
Mm.
Now, when I was actually, I was looking at the band members, and because I don't really, it's never bothered me who the names of people really, because I was just really into the music, because I didn't really know that many musicians, I suppose. I don't know, but I know, obviously, you've got Mick Ronson on guitar. And then I was thinking, Trevor Boulder on bass. Who's this Trevor Boulder guy? So I was looking into their background. And Mick Ronson joined a band called The Rats in 1966, which was Trevor Boulder's band. And then in 1968, a guy called Woody Woodmansey joined the band as well. And that happens to be the Spiders from Mars.
Indeed.
So and they are basically, they are The Rats.
They were, but the, you know, The Rats, they were an awesome band though, together, because when you see them performing as like a four-piece, you know, with David Bowie, they were absolutely incredible. And Trevor Boulder with that short-scale bass. Again, I know we're talking bass, but it's, you know, and Woodman's, it was just a great sound. The thing that really upset me, actually, because we love David Bowie, we listen to a lot of David Bowie, and we watched the documentary Beside Bowie with our friends and neighbours next door.
Yeah.
And Jackie and Ian. And it was like a... you know, a real bad vibe about Bowie, or what he did to the band, because he paid them a pittance, really, when they were doing The Spiders from Mars. And, you know, he was earning, you know, a reasonable amount of money from it all.
Yeah.
So it was like it left a bit of a bad taste in my mouth, that movie, really.
Mm, and, you know, obviously we're on the Isle of Man at the moment, and you're not supposed to say folklore. Well, basically, you can't say rat, because there's a superstition. So you have to, so they'd never be able to, if you were a radio presenter, would you have to say the RATs or, and here we have the Longtails, or here we have the Joeys, but you would never be able to say the name of the band.
That's right. I never thought about that. And of course, right now, talking to the Isle of Man, we're right in the middle of TT, and we have a punishing schedule of gigs. We've done, or we are in the middle of doing 17 gigs in 16 days.
That's right. So it's the Isle of Man TT road races. They're the most famous world race in the world. And they, it's 39 miles or 38.3 miles of racing full speed on real roads.
Yeah, craziness.
So we're gigging every night. In fact, we in about an hour, we're going out to play another gig.
That's right. So we better hurry up.
Yeah.
We'll be right back.
You're listening to The Supertone Show with Susie Starlight and Simon Campbell of the Starlight Campbell Band.
And that was T-Rex and 20th Century Boy, produced by Tony Visconti. Now, this was done in 1973. Mm-hmm. Tony Visconti, who is David Bowie's normal producer, right, produced this. So I think he did this rather than doing Aladdin Sane for David Bowie, the previous track.
Do you think?
Well, it's quite possible because Ken Scott, of course, worked with the Beatles, produced with David Bowie, Lady Grinchell, or that whole Lady Sane album.
Yeah.
So there we are. So he did this. And, you know, T-Rex, Mark Bowen, one of the masters of glam rock.
I've got it. He fancied a trip to Japan because they recorded this in Japan. Toshiba Studios.
No.
Yeah, so he went on a jolly to Japan. That's probably why he chose to do this album.
Ah, and David Bowie recorded at Trident Studios in London.
But they did, and I did read this after, when they came back to England, they recorded various other instruments, including hand claps.
Well,
I know they're difficult. I've done them. We've done them.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just really odd to cite that, though, you know.
The hand clap thing is hilarious, though, because everybody thinks they're really cool and in time. And when you listen to them later on, it's like everybody's in different rooms, not watching each other. You know, you go... It's like about three or four right after each other.
Oh, it's bad, isn't it? So that got to number three in the UK charts in 1973. And then again, it was re-released in 1991, 14 years after Mark Bowen died. And it was in, do you remember that Levi's advert with Brad Pitt? And they used that as a soundtrack.
I can't.
Well, no, neither could I. So I just watched it on YouTube. But sorry, it's true though. But it's really funny. There's this real young Brad Pitt, and he's in jail. And he comes out, and he gets a camera from this guy, and he comes out in his shorts and stuff. And this girl rocks up in this gorgeous, really old battered, but you know, a classic old American car, and throws him a pair of Levi's. So he gets dressed, and then they kind of have this kind of photographic session where they're holding each other and grinding on each other a bit, and. And then he drives off and he takes loads of photos of her and then chucks the camera to the guy in the prison who looks really pissed off basically because he's stuck there working and he's now off with this beautiful lady and he's out. And the strap line is, originals stand the test of time, Levi's.
And we are not sponsored by any way.
Oh, no, not at all. No, it was just that whole thing though. I was just thinking how obscure that it got back into the charts again because of an advert. But Mark Bolan, I want to play some more of his songs, you know, on the next few shows or whenever in the future, because this guy fascinates me. There's just something about this guy that I just think there's a lot of depth to him, and I just started to read, but it's so thick that, you know, you just couldn't put it all into one link. But he had his first guitar aged 9. He began a skiffle band, you know, and other people we know, like the Beatles and Lonnie Donegan, have done that kind of school thing. But he was in a band at school called Susie and the Hula Hoops.
No.
It was a trio. And the...
Was he Susie?
No.
No.
The vocalist was a 12-year-old Helen Shapiro.
No.
Oh, yeah.
The Shapiro lot.
Exactamente. Mm. So he used to play his guitar in lunchtime at school for his mates and stuff, and they have a small audience of friends. But then age 15, he got expelled from school for bad behaviour.
Wow.
You know, and that's just the beginning. But I like his attitude, you see. And I know that he was a pioneer of glam rock and stuff.
But you see, this isn't rock. And, you know, we've had a few emails about the show and saying that, you know, we're on a lot of blues-type shows or programmes and stations,
yeah.
And it's not blues. But there's nothing more bluesy than that song. But, you know, because it's basically, it is a 12-bar blues. That's what it is.
Yeah.
It's just couched in this glam rock with that more fuzz guitar, you know, and that vocal. But it's just a very clever melodic use of those three chords. That's it.
Do you know as well, I've got one last bit of trivia, which actually I do really relate to. You know, when I was growing up, I couldn't quite hear lyrics. And I'm sure loads of people have the same kind of thing. It's like, I always used to think that rock song was called Don't Make the Grown Man Cry. Well, I thought it was Crow-Man. So I was there rocking out, don't make the cruel man. But the best one was when, you know, I shot the sheriff,
yeah.
But I didn't shoot him up a tree. So anyway, I've read this bit. It says, the analysis of the multi-track recordings of 20th Century Boy reveals the first line of the song to be, friends say it's fine, friends say it's good. Everybody says it's just like Robin Hood, not rock and roll.
Ain't Talking About Love, Van Halen. Eddie Van Halen at his best from the first album.
I don't know anything about Van Halen. Tell me.
Well, the thing is with Eddie Van Halen is that what you got to do is you got to remember what when this was released. Yeah, it was about 1978, so it's 12 months after punk rock. So there's a lot of stuff going on, and he produced this very hard metal record with this incredible guitar sound, because I remember listening to it, and we were swamped with punk in the UK, and all of a sudden you got this very stylish beautifully played, overdriven guitar, and I thought, what the hell is this? Who is this bloke? And then you look at him and his hair's sticking out. It looks like he's had an electrical probe up his bum. And, you know, and all the guys, and they're all strutting around, you know, with the tight pants on and stuff. And the more I looked into him, the more interesting he became, because, you know, he loves guitar sound, he loves guitar tone. I'm reading a book by Phil Brown at the moment, the engineer, and he was saying that he was doing a session and Eddie Van Halen was in the studio, and he said that people just used to go in the control room and watch him because he was just electrifying to see.
Really?
Yeah. He was like an electrifying player. And the thing about Eddie Van Halen's guitar sound is that he uses Marshalls, or on this first record, he used Marshalls, and he turned the voltage down with the Variac to create this, what is known as a brown sound. So what happened, he actually starved the amplifier of voltage, and it gives this quite dark sound. Everybody was looking after this sound, and everyone's going, how's he doing it? How's he doing it? It sounds great. But of course, we all know that 90% of the sound is at the end of your arms, you know, with the fingers, and or 95% of it. And he was such a great player, and the whole record was great. And this song, he said, I think he said it wasn't good enough to present to the band. Is that right?
Yeah, for a year he wrote it. That's the bit I do know. So he held on to it, and I know that it was supposed to be a punk rock parody, like a stupid thing with just two chords, but he said it didn't end up sounding punk, but that was like the intention of it. So, and also as well, he studied classical piano at school, you know?
No.
Got ya. And I'm like, do you know, I think we're running out of time. I think that's it for this week's show.
Well, we better go after this gig.
Well, if you want to get in contact with us, we're on Instagram at Starlet Campbell, Twitter at Susie and Simon, and Facebook.
And the show is available on Mixcloud, Spotify, iTunes and iHeartRadio. So please tell your friends and come back next week.
Yeah, catch you later.